part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Prairie Ensemble, which presents Stravinsky's Complete Pulcinella Ballet, featuring dancers from the University of Illinois, on Friday, May 7th at 7:30 p.m. at Faith United Methodist Church in Champaign. Also included are works by Granville Bantock, Francis Poulenc, and Joan Tower. Tickets and information available at 355-9077 or on the web at prairieensemble.org.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. On the program today, what it's like to send a son to war. Our guest is a man whose son is a Marine. Frank Schaefer joins us in this portion of the program. He was our guest 13 months ago, shortly after his son, Corporal John Schaefer, was deployed to the Middle East. The father and son are the authors of Keeping Faith, a father-son story about love and the United States Marine Corps. Frank Schaefer continues their story in Faith of Our Sons, a father's wartime diary. When we last spoke, Frank Schaefer told us about how stunned he was by his son's decision in his last year of high school to join the Corps. After all, he said, he lives on the Volvo-driving, higher education-worshipping north side of Boston. He said prior to his son's decision to enlist, he didn't give much thought to who was defending the country. Listeners, you can join the discussion with your questions and comments. I look forward to your calls. You can join us with a telephone call. Here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Frank Schaefer, is a writer. His previous books include the novels Portofino, Zermatt, and Kelvin. His new book, Faith of Our Sons, is published by Carroll and Graff. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Frank Schaefer, welcome back.
Celeste, thank you. It's good to be with you.
Good to talk with you. John's back in the U.S. What can you tell us about his tour, his time in Afghanistan, and what are his plans?
Well, right now, he should be out of the Marine Corps in the end of July. I say should be because with everything going on in the world, you don't know. You know, if a national emergency occurs or something happens, they could keep him. But all things being equal, he'll get out, he'll be going to college and resuming a civilian life after 5 years of service in the Marine Corps, including 11 months of deployment in the Middle East. So, you know, I'm still worried, I'm still nervous, not only for him, but for all the other people who are deployed, but it's not as bad as it was for 11 months last year when he was out there facing roadside bombs and bullets, and, you know, we didn't get a good night's rest for the better part of a year. So now we're in a different stage, and of course, you know, we're just waiting to see what happens to him and a lot of other people.
Yeah. Last we spoke, he was on his way to the Middle East. And
yeah.
Faith of Our Sons opens with a diary entry about a telephone call you received from John telling you he would be deployed. Tell us about that. What did you say to one another?
Well, you know, first of all, let me just say, when John was deployed, just like when he went into the Marine Corps originally, it was somewhat of a surprise because he had a job in military intelligence, which would have allowed him to stay stateside, but he volunteered for an inter-service task force to be sent into a rather dangerous situation and missions in the Middle East. And so, you know, once again, we were kind of taking a deep breath, and I can just read you what we said here at the beginning of the book. Diary of Deployment, February 17, 2003, first entry. John called. He said he will be deployed. I am elated for my boy because he sounds happy. I'm elated in the same way one is elated by looking over a cliff. Adrenaline and terror also surge. We are about to go to war in Iraq and are already at war in Afghanistan. John could have sat out the action at a desk. I ask him if he volunteered for this mission. Yes, I did, but don't tell anyone, said John. You mean Mom? Yes. She'll be really upset if she knows I volunteered. I won't tell. What do you think, Dad? I'm proud of you and scared. What about you? I'm excited and nervous, said John. I could hear the excitement, but not the nervousness, as he added. I'll be doing special weapons training. You know, sort of a refresher course to get ready, all very cool. So that's kind of how the story starts, and basically we go from there through the year of deployment in this book, Faith of Our Sons. And really what I've done is also weave in some other stories of people, because having written Keeping Faith, I got literally many thousands of emails from other folks with people in the military, carried on quite a correspondence with a lot of people, and I worked about 80 of their letters into this book to try to give voice to, you know, the America that gives back more than it takes, and really show what it means to be a military family in today's America, which I don't think a lot of people get on a kind of a gut level. So, you know, one of the pleasures of writing Faith of Our Sons was that I was able to edit in these letters from people who had served everything from the First and Second World War all the way up into the present, with kids deployed along with my own son, and just give a flavor of the America that serves, and of which I became a very small and rather unwilling part through my own son. So that's kind of the story.
Yeah. You wrote a column that was published in the Washington Post in 2002, and it is repeated here in Faith of Our Sons.
Right.
And in that column you said, I feel closer to the waitress at our local diner than to some of my oldest friends. She has two sons in the Corps.
Yeah.
What kind of reaction did that op-ed piece receive from your oldest friends and the people who overnight had become your friends?
Well, you know, it's interesting, because John's deployment happened at a time of rapidly changing attitudes about the military. You know, when he first volunteered to go into the Marine Corps, this was before 9/11. Then 9/11 happened, and then the war in Afghanistan happened, and now we're at war in Iraq. So what for a lot of people was a very obscure, somewhat uninteresting story, that was the story of military service, something someone else did, maybe a grandfather, or, you know, they had a memory of an uncle who, you know, split for Canada during the Vietnam era or whatever, but it had nothing to do with them. That was sort of the climate at the beginning of John's deployment, or rather service. And now, of course, we're in an era where every single day of every paper in the country, there's a front page story about people in the military and military loss. So I have to quickly say, the world into which we wrote our first book and this world is a different one. And I think that column for the Washington Post kind of straddled the two. So when I wrote it, I was kind of writing from the context of people who were indifferent toward the military. But my article hit at a time when we were gearing up to go into Iraq. And so the attitude was different than it might have been beforehand. You know, when John first volunteered for the military, as I talk about in Keeping Faith, the attitude of some of his peers in the private school he was going to and some of the parents was really extraordinary. One parent actually went to the headmaster and said, we need to have a meeting to find out what went wrong in this case, as if somehow the fact that someone would volunteer for the military rather than going straight into a top college was a black mark against the school. Well, now, of course, you know, we're in a world where we see coffins flag draped on the front of our newspapers every day, and those sorts of things would be less politically correct to say. But nevertheless, the attitude of the class I come from, the kind of chattering class of writers and op-ed writers and this sort of thing, you know, very few of my friends have anybody personally involved in any of these wars. And so my sense has just been that, you know, one of the issues that I deal with in the book, Faith of Our Sons, although somewhat obliquely, is this whole issue of class in the military. It's just inescapable. And for instance, just give you one example. Right now, out of 535 members of Congress, there are only six members of Congress, five congressmen and one senator, who actually have kids who are in the military, which is sort of astounding when you think about this is the U.S. government that sends people to war. Of course, our president doesn't have a child serving. John Kerry makes a lot out of his own service, but his service-age kids are not serving, though, you know, they're working in his campaign. You know, we live in a day and age where one class of Americans serves, basically, and another doesn't. And then when you have someone like my son, who's a little bit of the exception, you know, right away it becomes a kind of a story. So, you know, what I kind of found out in this, in writing this book, as I put it, is that, you know, we have an all-volunteer military, but we, the platoon of parents, wives, children, husbands, and those who serve, have only one choice, to love or not. And our job is to struggle with our fears in plain sight of the carefree lives we used to live, and in plain sight of our friends and leaders who have no direct involvement, no one at risk, and no skin in the game. So it's a weird world. You know, everybody's paying attention to the war, but there's a very certain group of people that have kids involved, and a lot of the decision makers and the celebrities and the opinion makers and the chattering class, you know, none of them have a photograph of a beloved child at their elbow who actually is involved. And I think if more of those people did, it would be a different world, and the news would be reported differently, and indeed maybe the wars would be fought differently. So it's kind of a this book, Faith of Our Sons, a Father's Wartime Diary, is the story of one family's struggle with loss and fear as a son goes to war, but it's also the story of a class of Americans who don't get heard from enough on a human level by the people who quote-unquote matter. And so that's part of the issue, is the whole class issue of war and who serves.
Yeah, I think one of the most valuable things about this book, Frank, Faith of Our Sons, is the correspondence between you and a close friend by the name of Frank Gruber.
Yes.
And I want to talk about that more in just a moment. But first, let's go back and get a little bit more background. What led John to his decision to join the Marines?
Well, of course, that's what we explored in the book we wrote together, Keeping mm-hmm. Faith. But really, it was a combination of things. I mean, not to be cliche, there was a desire to serve his country, as simple as that. To be, as he put it, something, part of something more important than myself, I think is the way he put it in the book, and that's what he had told me. There was also a youthful desire, a macho male desire to have an adventure. You know, some kids take a year off from college or defer starting and go out and save some money and travel the world. Well, John's version of that was to be a Marine. So it wasn't only big issues and causes. It was just youthful adventure. Another was that he was somewhat unsure of what he wanted to study in college and really didn't want to waste his time till he knew. Another was that he was somewhat disenchanted with some of his peers. You know, he got on very well with his friends and had many friends, but nevertheless, you know, he wanted to look beyond the sort of drinking all weekend, partying syndrome, and do something that was going to help him be more disciplined. He wanted more discipline. He wanted to move forward with a more adult life. It was all those sorts of things. That's why he went into the military. And, of course, the reasons he went in and what he found there were two different things. As he put it in the book, Keeping Faith, you know, a lot of these people went into the military for all sorts of reasons that were his friends there, you know, from getting college tuition to paying bills to serving their country. But once in the Marine Corps and down at boot camp in Paris Island, they all learned an ethic of service that I guess can be stated as follows, and that is the Marine standing next to you is more important than you are. And they really absorb that, and that's why when they get out there in combat situations, they can rely entirely on each other, and as a nation, we can kind of rely on them as well to do their job, however difficult it gets, because they've in a way converted to this selfless ethic that I don't think most of the rest of the culture has.
Mm. Well, now your friendship with Frank Gruber and the email correspondence you shared, would you tell us about that friendship and that correspondence in the days and weeks leading up to the war and after it began?
Yeah, well, In the book, Faith of Our Sons, as I said earlier and you mentioned, we have correspondence from various parents and others, but I also have some people that I wrote to throughout the book, and one in particular is an old friend of mine who I've known for more than 15 years, who started out as my entertainment attorney when I was writing some screenplays out in Hollywood. We remained friends. We did some writing together, but we're kind of polar opposites, although we were born only 17 days apart, and have many of the same tastes in food and wine and the music we like and the films we like and the plays we like and so forth. Nevertheless, you know, his wife is an atheist. She's a Jew of the far left, of the old sort of school of far left liberal American. She's a philosophy professor. Frank is an entertainment lawyer, also a Jew, living in Santa Monica, California, the People's Republic of Santa Monica, California. My father was a Presbyterian minister. I grew up in Switzerland with missionary parents. I go to the Greek Orthodox Church. My politics are sort of all over the map. I'm conservative on some issues, liberal on others, but Frank is a straight, pull-the-lever, old-style liberal Democrat We disagree on certain issues. You know, Santa Monica probably produces less Marines per square foot than any territory in the United States. Well, so does the North Shore, where I come from, above Boston. But nevertheless, my son volunteered for the Marine Corps and was heading into a place that was totally unfamiliar to me, but even more so to Frank and Janet. But anyway, Frank and I are also best friends, and we love each other like brothers. And as a result, we're as rude to each other as family members are. And so we write what we think. And, you know, I would pull Frank's chain and write things to him such as, okay, now that my son's a Marine, I want you to hang a flag on your house and wear a yellow ribbon, knowing full well he'd never do it. He wouldn't be caught dead doing that in his neighborhood in Santa Monica. And then he would write back, and we would argue the issues, the liberal-conservative issue, who owns the flag, you know, why won't you hang a flag on your house, these sorts of things. And some of it was in good fun and good humor, but also some of it was very, very well meant and sincere, in the sense that, you know, at the time we were writing, I had a son out there getting shot at, and I didn't take too kindly to my my more liberal friends who, you know, were basically, you know, nitpicking over the meaning of the flag and whether it had been taken over the right wing or this sort of thing in that context. So we got into some pretty good heated arguments in the context of this book, Faith of Our Sons, where laced through the correspondence, there's a kind of a running debate on the meaning of patriotism, the meaning of service, the meaning of country. You know, where liberal and conservative politics ought to stop, and we should pull in the same direction, little hints of the culture wars and this sort of thing. So, you know, essentially what Frank became was almost my foil for my frustrations and my questions. And, you know, one example would be I was furious with him because in the same time frame John was going off to war, you know, he was throwing a big Oscar party out there in Santa Monica. And basically I was telling him, you know, I hope you choke on your salmon mousse. And, you know, have a terrible time because my son's out there. You know, what are you doing partying? And so, you know, we had a good time with these letters, but it also sort of brought up a point to me, and I think somewhat to Frank, too. And that was this kind of disconnect between the America that pays the price for these foreign adventures we get into and then the comfortable, well-heeled, well-educated America that sits back and to whom these issues are only news in the sense that they affect the next election result. It's all political or philosophical, but it's not on a gut level where you're waking up, sitting bolt upright in the middle of the night with tears on your cheeks, having dreamed for the umpteenth time that your son just got shot, which is where, you know, the parents of people being deployed today in Iraq and Afghanistan are, and where I was last year, and I'm just sort of recovering from that. So it really showed up, you know, here's my best friend. We've worked together in the entertainment business, but, you know, he lives on Venus and I live on Mars, and the twain shall never meet because his world and my world really were two really different things at that point. And in that context, that's what I meant when I wrote in that earlier column that, you know, I was closer to the lady in the diner and my garage mechanic who had kids in the military than I was to some of my oldest friends.
Yeah. There is a diary entry from April 13th of 2003 that I'd like to share with listeners, a portion of it, when you write that Frank Gruber had been visiting you. He'd come to town for some kind of an event, and he has just left, April 13th, 2003.
Yeah.
And you say, "Strange that with John gone to war, we still fight through our emails, but face to face, we were so intimidated by the war, we hardly dared argue. Being polite to Frank was very unsettling, as if we were observing decorum at a wake. However, I cooked him a great 7-rib pork roast, lightly hickory-smoked and glazed with a peach soy reduction."
Right.
So he's still a friend. He was a friend throughout this.
He was a great friend. And,
yeah.
And, you know, a lot of the times his advice was wonderfully helpful on a human level. Frank would write to me and just say, "Hey, look, you know, calm down, take a deep breath." You know, I would write to him ranting about, you know, nobody cares and, you know, you're going to your Oscar party and look at this, you know, look at the world you live in and it's selfish and, you know, I hope Santa Monica slides into the sea kind of idea. And he would write back in very good humor, "Look, take a deep breath. I know you're upset. I'm not going to yell at you because, you know, you have every right to be angry. This is a terrible situation." He just could not have been kinder. And I think one of the wonderful things that, in our friendship, but also that comes out of this exchange in the book, is that in the light of all the disagreements over the war and these culture wars we fight, you know, here I was with a son in the military, and here he is on the opposite end of the spectrum. And yet, you know, our friendship not only survived the situation, but came out stronger. And indeed, you know, without getting too mushy and sentimental, was a really good picture of why my son went to war to defend this country. You know, America's a great country. This is a country where, you know, a secular Jew can have a lifelong, warm, close brotherhood with a practicing Greek Orthodox Christian, and we're not trying to kill each other or anathematize each other, and we're not calling each other infidels, and all those terrible things that are happening in the name of religion today. And it provided, without in any way looking for it, I certainly didn't realize this until after I'd written the book, but I realized our little correspondence that runs through the book is almost a kind of object lesson in a lovely way of just what's so precious about this country of ours in terms of the kind of fundamentalist attacks that we see on our society from the radical Islamists, from Saudi Arabia and this sort of thing. You know, the friendship I have with Frank is just the opposite of that. It's the true mark of a pluralistic, tolerant culture. And it was a real blessing to me and still is. And Frank and I are, you know, wonderful and close friends. As a matter of fact, he's working right now on making sure that there'll be plenty of people at a book signing I'm doing out in Los Angeles in about 2 weeks that he's going to be hosting. And, you know, that's the sort of friendship we've got.
Yeah. Do you find yourself wishing that the national political discourse was more like the friendship you have with Frank?
Yeah, I do. I mean, yes, I do indeed. If you look particularly, I'll tell you where it really comes home in a very personal way that I find incredibly hurtful. You know, I'm so sick of the left-wing editorialists using the military as a pawn in their social wars with the right. And I'll give you an example, and that is the kind of condescending attitude that the only reason someone would volunteer is somehow because educational social programs have failed. Otherwise, they would have had quote-unquote real opportunities, and they wouldn't need to go into the military for educational money, this kind of thing. They don't really care about the soldiers and the Marines and the sailors and the airmen. What they care about is a social agenda, and they just use them. The same thing with opposition to President Bush. You know, there's a lot of people who hate his administration for good or bad reason, but I wish they wouldn't use the war in Iraq and what our military is doing as a whipping boy to kind of stick it to him. And I'd say the same thing in the reverse. I mean, remember when Bill Clinton launched missiles, you know, during a number of times against al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and also in the Sudan, the right wing were accusing him of trying to cover up for you know, his scandals and so forth and so on. And I have to say that in terms of the military, I think we owe the military and the parents that support them and the lovers and the wife and the husbands and all the rest of them a kind of a respect that takes at face value their non-political nature and doesn't use them as kind of pawns in this. And I think my friendship with Frank is something that's a real treasure to me. And one of the things it shows me is that you can have profound, even emotional disagreements with someone, but if you have a basic commitment there to love of country, not in some flag-waving, crazy, jingoistic way, but actually appreciation for the freedom and the diversity we have here, it doesn't lead to blows. And, you know, it's a subtext of Faith of Our Sons, but it's definitely there.
Hmm. What are your thoughts today about the war in Iraq?
Well, you know, just because I have a son who's in the military doesn't mean I speak with any expertise. And I would just say I pretty much stick with what I say in the book, and that is it's too early to tell, and that you know, we want the instant opinion, but we also want everything solved in 2 minutes. And this may sound like a cop-out, but I honestly, sincerely believe this. We're not going to know really what we think about this war for 20 years, maybe 10 or 15 at the least. I'm not saying we'll be there for 15 years, though we may well be. But the fact of the matter is, you know, if the conservative side is right, if the idea that we bring democracy to the Middle East and it takes hold and it gradually changes the climate there is to be worked out, it'll be a 20-year process. If it's wrong, we're really in trouble, and I just don't know. But I would say this. I don't believe for a minute, personally, that we ever went in there for the stated reasons. I think that the reasons were we wanted to shake up the status quo in the Middle East and kick some butt, show that we couldn't be pushed around, draw the line in the sand, and it could have been anywhere. It could have been Syria or Iran or Pakistan or Saudi Arabia, and Iraq was the easiest one, or at least they thought so at the time, and that's where we drew the line. But how this all works out in the end and whether it's to the benefit of America and democracy and freedom around the world, I just don't know. I think it's too early to tell. I do know one thing, though. I certainly have no romantic notion, speaking for myself just personally, about the intention of our enemies, and I believe that whether it's Iraq or Afghanistan or the Saudi Arabians or the Pakistanis with the nuclear weapons, you know, we have a real problem facing us, and that is that the chaos in the Middle East that's been caused by various reasons, including, I think, our own stupidity in many ways, has really caught up with us now, and we're not going to duck out of it. So whether you're a peace marcher or a gung-ho neoconservative, the fact of the matter is there are events taking place now that are bigger than we can control, and I think that's probably what I really think. We're caught in a moment of history, a real collision of cultures, and it's going to take many, many years to work out.
Frank Schaefer is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. He was our guest 13 months ago, shortly after his son, Corporal John Schaefer, was deployed to the Middle East. The father and son are the authors of Keeping Faith, a father-son story about love in the United States Marine Corps. Frank Schaefer continues their story in Faith of Our Sons, a father's wartime diary. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Has having a son who is a Marine, you're a father of three, and a husband, and a writer.
Yeah.
But we're talking about you as the dad of a Marine here this afternoon.
Yeah.
How has that affected you in terms of how you think of who you are?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think it's affected me in the sense of thinking through an intellectual position and coming to a new way of seeing myself. It's much more on a visceral, intuitive level, and that is it has very much sorted out what I care about and made it very, very basic. You know, while my son was deployed, I cared about his survival. It's a kind of raw emotion you feel when you're watching a child be born or you fall in love or you have terrific fear or adrenaline, but it's spread over a whole year. It's kind of hard to explain. In a way, time just stops. I feel like it was a 20-year period, not a one-year period. Mm-hmm. In another way, it makes me look at what I write in a kind of a more serious manner, and that is that I have three novels out, and I've got two more I'm working on, but I've put those two books aside for the moment while I work on these books related to my son's deployment. Part of that is a sense of wanting to give back a little bit. There's no question that that having been introduced to the military family community of America and realizing that their story is not told often enough, for instance, in including so many letters from other people in Faith of Our Sons, you know, that wasn't done by chance. That was done because I really have a sense of honor and awe about these people that I wouldn't have had before. So it's kind of changed my priorities as a writer in the sense that I'm not only interested in just telling my own story in semi-biographical novels like Portofino and Zermatt as much as I am now in making sure that, to the best of my ability, in a very small, humble way, on the edges of things compared to the big time, but nevertheless, that I make my little contribution to make sure that the mothers and the fathers and the wives and the young widows and the children of some of these servicemen and women get a fair shake, that they're heard from, that people understand that these are not deadbeats. These are not people who went into the Marine Corps or the military because they couldn't do anything else. They went in for a variety of reasons, but they choose to keep serving and doing their job, and they should be respected for that, and I would like people to get them to know them better. And in that sense, I'm on a little bit of a mission. I don't know how long it'll last, but there's certainly several books worth here of trying to make sure that people understand that this is not a victim culture of an underclass that serves because it can't come up with anything better or didn't get its proper social services, but that there are a lot of real altruists here who, however they got into the service, are continuing to serve because they believe in what they're doing. And I'd like people to know them better and to know their families better. So I see that a little differently. And the other thing I see differently that I think especially in writing Faith of Our Sons has come out is that it makes me look at our celebrity culture very differently. You know, our military families are burying their dead while the rest of us are fretting about the Atkins diet. And, you know, you look at the vapid airbrush celebrities on 1,000 women's magazine covers, and you'd never guess that there are young women of terrific substance and character and uniform fighting for us. each of those women ready to sacrifice her life for her country. And you wonder, you know, what is the values of a culture that sticks a Christina Aguilera endlessly on a magazine cover or a Vogue model or whoever it might be, when these the people who are actually the role models for supposedly, you know, what we would like young women to be in this country, responsible, dedicated, hardworking, mature, grown up, selfless, you know, abound, but you know, they're in desert camouflage now in some dusty hellhole servicing a chopper at Bagram Air Base, and they're not on the cover of the magazine unless it's as a victim, you know, because they just were killed or something like this. So it kind of has turned, you know, I don't read news stories the same anymore. I was reading a news story the other day in Time Magazine, or rather in the New York Times, that was saying that certain colleges are providing pets and puppies to their students to therapeutically help them deal with the stress at exam time. You know, and basically it asks a question. And you know, these young people are never asked to serve their country even for a day, and nor are the rest of us. And yet there's a disproportionate burden borne by these people who volunteer. So I guess I see this social issue of who serves and who doesn't. It really colors the way I think as a writer, particularly in terms of my nonfiction. I'm a little more issue-oriented than I used to be.
I wonder if it will change your work as a novelist.
I would think so. I would think so, in the sense that, you know, somehow this will work itself out in some fiction down the road somewhere, I would think. And if it does, I would certainly have a better handle on the characters than I ever would have before, but also just have a little more of a social conscience maybe than my work would have had before. But, you know, right now I'm doing it in nonfiction, in Faith of Our Sons, and trying to reflect in that a kind of seriousness of purpose that comes through learning through personal suffering. You know, there's nothing that concentrates the mind so much as having a beloved child out there in the face of enemy fire. And, it certainly changes the way one sees one's life, especially the more trivial aspects of it. Of course, there's, you know, life is still is not without humor, and my books like Portofino and Saving Grandma and Zermatt and so forth are works of humor as well as works of fiction. But and Faith of Our Sons also has humor in it because funny things continue to happen. But you know, it's humor against a backdrop of something rather more serious.
Yeah. And some surreal stuff, too.
Yeah.
I mean, the day Baghdad falls, Oprah calls.
Right, right. That was odd. You know, I was sitting here just literally, you know, in anguish and in tears, and my son is being sent out, and I don't know where he is. And then the phone rings, and it's the Oprah Winfrey Show wanting to talk to me about the last book I did, Keeping Faith. And, you know, it was so odd because it's like, well, can't they get the time right? You know, last year, before all this happened, I would have just been over the moon with joy and gone and opened a bottle of champagne because it would have meant that some book of mine was going to be a bestseller. But at that point, it was almost like, well, what do they want? You know, don't they know there's a war on, and don't they know my son just got deployed? Of course, on the other hand, being a writer, I went fast enough, and I took advantage of it and sold as many books as I could. But it was a really odd frame of mind that I was in, because it was almost as if I was had been transported to the wrong planet, or, you know, turned the first page of a book and found that it had been printed wrong and it was the last page of the story. And, you know, it was completely out of sequence to have sort of good things happening to me as a writer in terms of promotion. Very weird, actually, because, you know, first of all, they're calling to talk about the book. They're calling me because my son's at war. So the book is going to sell better because he's out there getting shot at. And in the end, your emotions become very convoluted. You don't know if you're happy or sad. And then there's always this sense of guilt of, you know, what am I doing selling a book based on the fact that my son has made a certain sacrifice and now people are interested in that? Almost like writing a book, you know, about a child who dies or some problem your parent had. And but, of course, if you really look at it as a writer, and maybe there's some self-justification here, but I can't see it any other way, you know, writing is recycling your life and other people's lives and offering them up for public consumption. So when something interesting happens, that recycling happens a little faster, and the rest of the time you just sort of go along at a slower pace, but you're always kind of crunching your own experiences and regurgitating them for you, for readers. So, you know, there was nothing new there. It just got a little more edgy, in that it involves something so dramatic as your son being at war.
Hmm. Frank Schaefer is our guest this afternoon. His latest book, Faith of Our Sons, A Father's Wartime Diary. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Let's talk with a listener who's waiting to talk with us on line one. Good afternoon. Where are you calling from?
Hi, I'm calling from Champaign.
Okay.
And I have a question for your guest. I appreciate his words and look forward to picking up a copy of his book and giving it to some friends who I think will appreciate it as well. And my question is one of advice-seeking. What he would advise for those of us, and there are many of us around the country who publicly oppose the war in Iraq and oppose the administration's policies in going to Iraq and want to be visible and public in that opposition while remaining very respectful and hold in regard the servicemen and women and their families who are making a great sacrifice.
Well, that's a really good question. Well, what's your first name?
Peggy.
Hi, this is Frank here. Good question. And interestingly enough, very much where my friend, my dear friend Frank Gruber, I was talking about earlier is that we exchange correspondence in the book Faith of Our Sons talking about this issue. Frank's writing to me about how he opposes the war and yet is so supportive of my son. You know, in one way, it sounds hypocritical to say you oppose the war, but you support the military, but it isn't really. I think, you know, that's the great thing about the United States of America. Look, Frank, one of my son's best friends, and I talk about this in the war from his childhood, was in such deep opposition to the war that he was actually born in overseas, and he wanted to go to another country and see if he could renounce his American citizenship. You know, well, John never said anything like, well, you know, he ought to be killed or something. He just said, well, at least he has a point of view, and, you know, that's better than not having any opinion. So for the first thing I would say is you would be pleasantly surprised with people like me and a lot of military folks I know, and certainly the young people in the military, to understand that when they say they are serving their country to defend the freedom to dissent, they actually mean it in a very guileless, straightforward way, and therefore you know, are not going to be as upset with you as maybe some flag wavers from the sidelines who aren't actually serving. I think the people who serve, you know, honor opinion. And I think, you know, the only advice I would give is that I think we have to distance ourselves sometimes for some really bad things that have happened before. I mean, there's a cultural memory of the sort of Jane Fonda protest of the war that, whether she did it or not, had the idea that somehow you were against the Vietnam War and therefore against the military. You mocked the military. Songs mock the military. Flags get burnt. Soldiers get spit on when they come back. That's, unfortunately, people remember that. And so it's, I think one thing the American left, and especially those who are opposing this war, could do is verbally distance themselves from that and just say, look, that's not us, and go out of their way doing practical things. I mean, you know, there are 130,000 troops over there, all of whom would love to get a package with some hand sanitizer and some foot powder and some hard candy. There's all kinds of people over there who, whatever you think of the war, are doing a great humanitarian job, whether it's building schools or taking care of children. Look, I'm getting letters from a chaplain who is right now, you know, asking for people to send toys over for these kids and school supplies for children that he's helping who were you know, in a terrible situation, being enslaved in a brick kiln factory that they were working in, little girls and boys, 5, 6 years old, that he's working with. Well, even if you're against the war and don't think he should be there for political or military reasons, we can still support what he's doing in the sense of being glad for that particular kid that they're getting a chance to learn to read. Even if that's not a good enough reason for the United States to go to war. So I think the people who oppose the war can not only say nice things about the troops, but can go out of their way to actually do something practical for the men and women on the ground, and also go out of their way to distance themselves from past protest movements that have abused our military people verbally and in other ways, and also, in addition to which, you know, state very clearly in their protests and their literature and other things that they honor and support the right of the United States military to be a strong military force, and the training and the selflessness, not run it down, and really go after what they really are against, which is the public policy of the Bush administration, and make that very clear. I think if those things happened, a lot of the bitterness and the sting in the sort of cultural conflict over these issues would be taken out. In exactly the same ways from the other side, you know, you'll have someone like my son there in his dress blue uniform, and an old school friend of his from his very liberal private school comes up to him and tells him he's against the war, and, you know, his reaction is, well, good for you. You know, I'm not a warmonger. I'm a professional military person who volunteered to serve his country. That doesn't mean I support everything that country does any more than a letter carrier working for the United States Post Office supports, you know, the content of every letter he delivers, but it's still his job to deliver it. Even if it's something he even if it's a piece of hate mail he disagrees with, he's still a letter carrier. That's what he said he would do. So I think that, you know, if we can approach it that way and with some basic common understanding and love for the United States and a love for the men and women who are out there putting their lives on the line, we could take some of the sting out of that.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. It's helpful, and I'm sure it is for everyone else who's listening today as well.
Well, thank you for your question. It's a really good one.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Military service is an issue in this presidential campaign. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, you know, I have a little bit of a quirky take on this, and I can share it with you. You know, it's less about, okay, look, I have an angle here. I'm not pretending I don't have an axe to grind. I have a son who's serving. I did not serve in the military. When John volunteered, I was surprised, as I talked about in Keeping Faith, a father's son love, a story about love in the United States Marine Corps. And now in Faith of Our Sons, a father's wartime diary, I'm still following his story. So in terms of the presidential politics, look, a lot of people say this is a big issue. And how did they serve, and, you know, where was President Bush, and what did John Kerry do? But my angle is a little different, and that is President Bush refers to the U.S. military as our finest young men and women, yet his service-age daughters did not volunteer. And, you know, the president acts as if war is heck, but there is no need for us to make sacrifices, and somehow everything can be fine. And Senator Kerry, you know, flaunts his veteran status, but he didn't inspire his own children to serve in the war he voted for. And he's been speaking on college campuses, telling students to get involved. But the would-be commander-in-chief, you know, has not told any of the students he's been talking to that maybe they should consider military service. So, you know, my sense is that the Republican and the Democratic candidate, when it comes to military service, are more the same than different. And that is, they come from a class of Americans, wealthy Americans, connected Americans, who leave the dirty work to other people. I am not very fond of either party. You know, the right-wing leaders who are waving the flag, you know, my question to them is, where are your children? And to the left-wing that say, we have solidarity with working men and women, I'd say, well, the people you say you want to get medical benefits for and all sorts of things for, educational benefits, that's the class of people who are providing sons and daughters to the military. So how about you show some solidarity by encouraging your own children to volunteer once in a while? You know, Eleanor Roosevelt wrote of her wartime farewell to her sons. This is Eleanor Roosevelt writing, who had all her children in the military during the war, unlike our present leaders. She wrote, I imagine every mother felt as I did when I said goodbye. Life had to go on, and you had to do what was required of you, but something inside of you died. End of quote. Well, it's been a long time since our country was led by people who could honorably identify with every mother and father whose experience the pride and the sorrow of saying farewell to a son or daughter who has volunteered to defend us. And most of us, including our political leaders, seem to have the attitude we can fight a war and let the good times roll. But, you know, I say, in the light of the pictures of our soldiers praying over the dead on the battlefield, isn't it time that we find ways to share their sacrifice, whether we support the war or not, or to at least behave as if we're at war rather than on a perpetual spring break? So I kind of have a different view, and I really don't care what Kerry did in the war. Look, I wasn't in the war. Who am I to say anything? And I don't care what Bush did. But I really do care that there's a whole class of political leadership that is not raising their children in a way that gives them an awareness that service is an option. I mean, you know, ask yourself, would you be surprised if Hillary and had raised Chelsea to volunteer? I would, because I'd say, oh, those sorts of people don't serve anymore. Well, why not? Hillary said that Roosevelt was her hero. Well, Eleanor's kids all volunteered. You know, since when has service become a dirty word, unthinkable? Well, for all the liberal claims about, you know, war and morality and all this, look, the fact of the matter is, the kids down at Harvard who are a few minutes away down the road from me and their parents, you know, are interested in getting their kids on the fast track to making money, prestige, position. You know, services is just as much a dirty word to the right as it is to the left, and basically I'm saying we're going to have to rethink our priorities, and it's not good for our country that none of us are asked to make sacrifices except for those kids who volunteer and their families, and that's basically my bottom line.
Hmm. There, we'll leave it. We're out of time. Frank, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
I appreciate it so much.
Frank Schaefer has been our guest. His latest book, Faith of Our Sons, A Father's Wartime Diary. He and his son, Corporal John Schaefer, are also the authors of Keeping Faith, A Father-Son Story About Love in the United States Marine Corps. Both books are published by Carroll and Graff. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade this afternoon, fun day at the Board of Trade. If you're in the bean pit, futures moving sharply higher on some technical buy signs for the day. 38.5 cents higher in the nearby May contract. The November was up 18.75. We'll take a complete look at those numbers in a moment. Let's start where we always do in the wheat pit for the day. They finished 4.25 higher in the nearby May contract at 382 high, low at 375.5, and a settlement price once again for the May wheat up 4.25 cents at 378.25. July futures 391.5 the high, the low at 384.25. Settled 388.5. They were 5.5 higher in the September. 396, the high, the low at 390. Settled 393.75, up 5.75. December futures in the wheat pit, 406.5. The high, the low at 399. Settled up 6 cents at 404.25. In the March contract, 410, the high, the low at 405. A settlement price at 409. They were 5 higher. May corn futures, 313, the high, the low at 302.5. A settlement price at 309.25, up 8 cents for the day. July futures, 320, the high, the low at 308. Settlement price at 315.5, up 8.25. In the September contract, 9 higher, 316.5, the high, the low at 306. Settled 314. It settled 9 cents higher for that September contract. December futures now 315.75, the high, the low at 304, and they settled 312. They finished the day 9 higher too. March contract 9 higher as well, 317.5, the high, the low at 308. Settlement price at the March 315.25. May futures 320.5, the high, the low at 310.25. The May 05 contract 317, a settlement price up 9, and July futures 9 higher for the day. At 320.5 high, low at 310.25. July 05, 317, settlement price 9 higher. December futures 2 years out for the 2005 contract, 278 the high, the low at 276.5, a settlement at 277.25, and they finished up just 1.5 cents. May oats for the day, 173 the high, the low at 166.5. Settled at 172.25, up 6 cents. And July futures, 179.75 the high, low at 173.25, settled 179.5, up 6.25 for the day. From the soy complex now, May beans for the day up above the $10 mark, $10.09 the high, the low at 974, pretty good spread, $10.03 the settlement price, 38.5 cents higher on the day. July beans, $10 even for the high, the low at 966, settled 994.5, up 36.5, and the August soybeans, 943.5 the high, the low at 910, settled 936.25. They were up 33 cents for the day. September futures 819 the high, the low at 797.5, and settlement price at 813.5. They were up 24. And your new crop November 757.5 the high, the low at 739. They were lifted higher along with the nearby 751.5. The settlement price there up 18.75. That despite the fact that yesterday's USDA crop progress and weather report showed that in the Delta region, the folks in Mississippi had 65.5% of their crop in the ground as of last Sunday. January beans now, 756 the high, the low at 744. Settlement price at 751.5, up 18.5 cents. In the March soybeans, 748 the high, the low at 735. A settlement price at 743.75, up 14.75. The boys in the Delta chasing that premium that might come in August. 310.30 for the soybean meal for the May contract high, low at 303. Settled 308.20, up 7 for the day. And the July bean meal, 309 the high, the low at 302. Settled 307. They were up 7.30. May bean oil for the day, 34.47, the high, the low at 33.03, settled 34.26, up 1.33, and July futures 34.15, the high, the low at 32.90, and a settlement price at 33.95, they were up 1.32 for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. Celeste?
Thank you, Todd. A higher day today for cattle. Lean hogs finished lower, May bellies were up. April feeder cattle, 95.80, the high, 95.55, the low, 95.57.5, the settlement, that up 27.5. May, 95.10, the high, 94.60, the low, 94.80, the settlement, that up 35. August, 96 even, the high, 95.10, the low, 95.50, the final price, that down 22 and a half. April live cattle, 84.30 the high, 83.35 the low, 84.17 and a half the settlement, that up 75. June, 78.50 the high, 77.50 the low, 77.82 and a half the settlement, that up 2.5. August, 80.20 the high, 79.52 and a half the low, 79.95 the settlement, that up 7.5. October, 80.95 the high, 80.10 the low, 80.82 and a half the settlement, that up 50. May lean hog, 72.07 and a half the high, 70.25 the low, 71.40 the settlement, that down 67 and a half. June, 72.92 and a half the high, 70.67 and a half the low, the settlement 71.27 and a half, that down 140. July, 73.25 the high, 71.20 the low, the settlement 72.45, that down 52 and a half. August lean hog, 70.70 the high, 68.90 the low, the final 70.20, that down 22 and a half. And May pork bellies, 109 today's high, 105.90 the low, 107.80 the settlement, that up 122 and a half. The Dow up 34 points at 10,478. The NASDAQ is down 5 points at 2032, and the S&P 500 is 4 higher at 1139.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department now offers boxed lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Roger Harding from Rogue River, Oregon writes, "Dear Dr. Science, my yard is rutted with gopher holes. Why hasn't the earth collapsed from all the holes that all the gophers over time have dug?"
It has, several times. The destruction of Atlantis in 954 AD was a direct result of a large gopher infestation, the same surplus of subterranean rodents that caused the Dark Ages in Europe. Many biblical miracles can be explained by gopheric intervention. I'd recommend the excellent Gophers, UFOs, and the Holy Land, narrated by Leonard Nimoy or Robert Stack, shown virtually nonstop on cable TV. There's no way you can stop a determined gopher. My advice is move. Do it now. Don't even go home to pack. Cut your losses, unless you want to be the subject of a cable TV special narrated by Leonard Nimoy or Robert Stack.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
To order the Dr. Science Smug Mug 6-Pack, call 800-989-DUCK.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners. EAGCO Incorporated, Fairmont.